The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
Oh, Judah. Rest. Sleep. For a few hours of the night, let your mind be at peace.
Peace. Love and peace. Do you think I don't long for them as much as you do? Where do you see them?
If you had heard this man from Nazareth.
Balthazar's word.
He's more than Balthazar's word. His voice traveled with such a still purpose. It was more than a voice. A man more than a man. He said, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God."
Children of God? In that dead valley where we left them? I tell you, every man of Judea is unclean and will stay unclean until we've scoured off our bodies the crust and filth of being at the mercy of tyranny.
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, December 24th, 2025. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing. It's Just Right.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Let me begin today's show by wishing one and all a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And as difficult as some might find it to believe, each term in that seasonal greeting, the Merry Christmas and the Happy New Year, fundamentally describe the origins of Western culture's history and current status in a way that most take for granted. I mean, given the time of year and the season, it is well to acknowledge that irrespective of anyone's particular religious beliefs or lack thereof, that Western culture can justifiably be described as a Christian culture. For example, just look at your calendar. On January 1st, the year will read 2026, and the significance of that number count is that it began at the time of Christ and within the Roman Empire, whose fundamental civilizational structures still exist to this day. But of course, Christianity is not the only major religion sharing the globe. There are other religions whose values stand diametrically opposed to Christian values, as broadly as they may be expressed. And in terms of the political polarity of left and right, I might place Christianity and Judaism broadly on the right, given that life is their standard of value, and the religion of Islam is being on the left, given its inherent death cult culture about which its leaders boast continually. And it must be acknowledged that in many ways, religion is culture, culture is religion, and both culture and religion manifest themselves in politics. And once again, in the supposed season of peace on earth and goodwill towards men, earth is embroiled in conflict and war, with much of it explicitly justified by religion, although personally I think that's rarely the real motivation. Like politics, religion is a divisive force, insofar as the values of competing religions are polarized along a left and right divide. And throughout the course of today's presentation, we'll be focusing on religion's influence on politics, and how the politics of religion itself affects the greater political zeitgeist. And that begins right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org. Hear us on WBCQ and on Channel 292 Shortwave. Follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform. And visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. Now, ever since I can remember, my family faithfully celebrated Christmas each and every year in basically both a religious sense and in a secular sense. Would I describe myself as a Christian? Well, I'd be lying if I did, because that would imply that my personal and social values were significantly derived from the teachings of Christ. But that's not the case. That being said, however, I was raised a Roman Catholic and in my youth was actively involved in the church, from singing in the choir to being an altar boy at a time when masses were still being served in Latin. And in this context and time, I certainly considered myself to be Christian. But apparently I was wrong even back then. In fact, I recall very clearly when I was very young, still in primary school, when I was informed by a Protestant friend of mine that because I was Catholic, I was not a Christian. Now, at the time, that was news to me, because up until then, I had always assumed that I was. After all, like I said, I attended church regularly, and as an altar boy who served masses in Latin, I can personally attest that Jesus Christ was pretty much a regular feature and personality within the teachings of the Catholic Church I was attending. And although I didn't know it then, my Protestant friend was possibly in the religious category of what is being called an evangelical Christian, which would reject the concepts of the Vatican and the idea that the papacy is representative of Christ's teachings. And of course, given that the Vatican is a political institution, that might lend some credibility to my Protestant friend's case. And so, of course, there has been a long-standing conflict between Catholics and Protestants. After all, it was Catholicism that the Protestants were protesting against. And then, of course, there are the other religious divisions and alliances throughout history between Christians and Jews, and the ever-divisive ideology of Islam, which is less a religion than a political movement, as we'll be examining later in the show. Now, all around the world, Islamists have been disrupting and sabotaging Christmas celebrations and publicizing their intolerance for the entire world to see, to say nothing of what we all just saw with the terrorist mass shootings at Jewish celebrations in Australia. It's events like the Australian shootings that also helped to garner sympathy and support for the Jewish people, which in turn manifests itself into the whole debate about why so many American politicians put Israel first instead of putting America first as they promised. And to kick off that conversation, here's the following commentary and presentation by yet another voice new to me, Olivia Swing, whose December 13 podcast was entitled, Israel is Tearing the Right Apart, and No One's Noticing.
Picture this. You're an average American, and one day at church, your pastor tells you that God is commanding America to support Israel, unconditionally. But wait, aren't church and state supposed to be separate? Oh, but then you find out your congressman just voted to send billions of dollars overseas, while your own town has bridges falling apart and people literally living on the street. And when you ask why, when you just ask the question, you get called anti-Semitic. That's exactly what's happening to the most loyal voices in MAGA right now. They're asking why Israel comes before Americans, and they're getting destroyed for it. Trump unendorsed Marjorie Taylor Greene, the woman who defended him through impeachments, through January 6th, through everything. She called what's happening in Gaza a genocide. He dropped her. Candace Owens questioned support for Israel. Well, she got fired. Tucker Carlson said maybe we shouldn't send billions to a country of 9 million people while Americans are struggling. He got canceled. These are the voices that built MAGA, and they're being expelled for asking one question. Why are we unconditionally supporting Israel? And this is tearing the right apart. One side says it's biblical, the other side says we were betrayed. Okay, so let's start with what nobody can deny. Israel has unprecedented influence over American politics. Politicians from both parties making pilgrimages to the Western Wall in Jerusalem. They're touching the wall, praying, performing rituals for a foreign nation.
Well, our prayer is that America will always stand with Israel. That's what scripture tells us to do. It's a matter of faith for us and a commitment that we have.
But it's not just the money. No. Laws are being passed right now that criminalize criticism of the Israeli government under the guise of combating anti-Semitism. Think about that. Laws that make it illegal to criticize a foreign government. This is real. This is documented. This isn't conspiracy theory. This is American foreign policy. But here's the thing. Democrats support it. Establishment Republicans support it. So there's basically a total bipartisan consensus of unwavering support for Israel. So why is MAGA so upset? Here's what people need to understand about the whole MAGA movement. Okay, it brought together this wild coalition of people who normally wouldn't agree on anything at all. truly. You know, you had libertarians, independents, centrists, constitutional conservatives, even former Bernie supporters, people from all over the political spectrum who were just fed up with the establishment. And here's the critical part. It brought together Zionists and non-Zionists. These people didn't agree on religion, they didn't agree on theology, they didn't even all agree on social issues, but they united around a few core things, right? You know, like ending the forever wars, securing the border, making housing affordable, draining the swamp, please, and maybe most importantly, putting America first. But now that coalition is fracturing because one group within MAGA, the Zionists, believes that supporting Israel isn't just good policy, it's not optional. It's a biblical mandate from God himself, actually. And everyone else in the coalition is going, wait, hold on, that is not what we signed up for. Here's the question we need to answer. What even is Zionism? And why do some Christians seem to care about it more than Jewish people do? Okay, quick history lesson. I'm gonna do my best with this. So Zionism is, you know, the belief that Jewish people should have their own state. Well, it wasn't born from the Bible. It was born from politics. In the late 1800s, a guy named Theodor Herzl watched anti-Semitism explode across Europe, and he said, Jews need their own state. In 1897, he organized the first Zionist Congress. And problem, the place he picked, Palestine, already had 600,000 people living there. Then in 1917, Britain made a promise. The Balfour Declaration. It was a letter to Lord Rothschild, you might have heard of that family before, saying Britain would support a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. Now, here's the wild part, okay? The guy who wrote it, Arthur Balfour, the same Arthur Balfour who 12 years earlier had passed Britain's Aliens Act, specifically to keep Jewish refugees out of Britain. So Balfour didn't want Jews in Britain, but he was happy to promise them someone else's land. In Palestine, where other people already lived. Oh, and Britain had already promised that same land to the Arabs and the French. Fast forward to 1948, Israel is declared a state. About 750,000 Palestinians are expelled, and the justification? Jewish people needed safety after the Holocaust, but Palestinians, who had nothing to do with the European genocide, they paid the price. So here's what matters. This wasn't a biblical mandate. This was political maneuvering by European powers. But that's political Zionism, and that's not even what's tearing MAGA apart. Because there's actually another kind of Zionism, and this one is way, way more influential in American politics. Brace yourself, because this could be hard for you to hear. It might touch on something deeply personal. Your faith, your pastor, your church, and I promise you I am not here to attack your faith, I'm really not. But I'm asking you to listen with an open mind, because you deserve to know the full story. So, what if I told you that a lot of what American evangelicals believe about Israel and end times prophecy was essentially inserted into Christianity through one book? In 1909, a guy named Cyrus Scofield published something called the Scofield Reference Bible. It was the King James Bible, but with Scofield's own commentary notes printed right alongside the actual scripture. And these notes taught something called dispensationalism, which is this idea that God has different plans for Jews versus Christians, and that the modern state of Israel plays a critical role in end times prophecy. Here's what Scofield wrote about Genesis 12:3, which is, I will bless them that bless thee and curse them that curseth thee. His note said, has invariably fared ill with the people who have persecuted the Jew, well with those who have protected him. The future will still more remarkably prove this principle. Genesis 12:3 is about God's promise to Abraham, but Scofield applied it to how modern nations should treat the Jewish people, and by extension, the modern state of Israel, which didn't even exist yet in 1909. The Scofield Bible was published by Oxford University Press, and it was heavily marketed. It became the standard reference Bible in seminaries and churches across America, especially in the massive Southern Baptist Convention. It sold millions of copies. But here's where it gets even more interesting. After Scofield died, Oxford University Press kept revising his notes. Mm-hmm. In 1984, they published the new Scofield Study Bible and added this line, for a nation to commit the sin of anti-Semitism brings inevitable judgment. They intensified the interpretation. They made it stronger. And then modern Christian Zionist leaders like John Hagee, who's the founder of Christians United for Israel, well, they took it even further, okay? Hagee says, the man or nation that lifts a voice or a hand against Israel invites the wrath of God. Do you see the progression? Schofield started it, Oxford University Press amplified it after his death, and now megachurch pastors are preaching it as absolute biblical truth. Entire generations of Americans grew up believing these interpretations were basically as authoritative as scripture itself, as demonstrated by the infamous Ted Cruz and Tucker Carlson interview.
Where does my support for Israel come from? Number one, because biblically we're commanded to support Israel. But number two,
Hold on. You're a senator and now you're throwing out theology, and I am a Christian and I am allowed to weigh in on this. We are commanded as Christians to support the government of Israel?
We are commanded to support Israel.
And there's evidence this wasn't organic. Schofield had close relationships with wealthy financiers, specifically a Wall Street lawyer named Samuel Untermyer, who was a passionate Zionist. Some historians suggest Untermyer helped fund and promote Schofield's career, including his trips to Europe, where he connected with Oxford University Press. Whether that's true or not, the result is undeniable. Okay, American evangelical Christianity was fundamentally reshaped to support the idea that blessing Israel, meaning the modern political state, is a biblical mandate. And here's the uncomfortable part. A lot of theologians, including conservative Bible-believing scholars, call dispensationalism heresy. They say it's a complete distortion of what scripture actually teaches. But it's running rampant through megachurches in America.
It's the first time in history the state of Israel has officially partnered with 1,000 strategic pastors to commission them as ambassadors to combat anti-Semitism and reach the youth of their generation.
Dr. Mike Evans says Israel's fight is not just on the battlefield.
Right now there's an ideological war that Israel's losing. So they need the evangelicals, they need the Zionists to fight an ideological war.
One of the goals of this gathering is to strengthen Christian support during a time of growing global anti-Semitism. They say the pulpit must speak louder than the propaganda.
Pastors are teaching it from the pulpit. Christians are being sent on free trips to Israel, funded by pro-Israel organizations. And church curricula are being shaped to promote this theology.
We're launching in 2026 a global program to reach 1 million pastors and 1 million churches globally to teach them a biblical worldview so they realize God's not canceling any promises to the Jewish people. And he's not canceling for the Christians either.
And church curricula are being shaped to promote this theology. And millions of evangelical Christians now believe that supporting the modern state of Israel, no matter what its government does, is non-negotiable. So, you've got tens of millions of American Christians supporting Israel, not out of concern for Jewish safety, but because they need Jews in Israel to fulfill their own religious narrative. Here we have what looks like foreign policy being preached as biblical mandate, influencing how millions of Americans vote and pressuring politicians to send billions of dollars overseas.
So it's just, I think, an extraordinary time for pastors to go to their pulpits and to speak with clarity and with boldness and to push back on the anti-Semitism, the bigotry that is being pushed toward Jewish people and toward the people of Israel.
And this is what's tearing MAGA apart.
If anyone still believes that these conflicts are about religious differences in faith and not about politics, then they missed the entire movie. From where I sit, politics and religion are essentially indistinguishable from one another. Politics concerns governance. Religion and ideology are the ideas and values on which governance will operate. And dare I say that most prophecies are of the self-fulfilling variety? I'm not here to attack your faith, says Olivia Swing, as if she were addressing the handicapped or mentally retarded or very young children and doesn't want to offend their fantasies or irrational sensitivities. It's a familiar sentiment expressed by relatively rational and well-meaning people towards religious people. I'm not here to attack your faith, they say, yet every reference to a fact that refutes a given faith is an attack on that faith. So why the dishonesty? I mean, if you knew that someone believed in a falsehood based on mistaken assumptions or understandings strictly of a secular nature, you wouldn't be apologizing for trying to correct them about whatever the issue was. But if they believed the same falsity based on faith, suddenly we're being condescending to them. Consider the implication of saying that you're not here to attack someone's faith. After demonstrating that certain passages in the King James Bible, on which many Christian Zionists apparently base their faith in Israel is not of biblical origin but historically recent political maneuvering, she nevertheless is saying that it's okay to continue believing in your falsehood as long as you do it on the basis of faith or religious conviction. This is not only tearing MAGA apart, it's tearing humanity apart, because as a means of obtaining knowledge, faith and reason are incompatible. It seems to me that attacking faith, quote unquote, should be a moral imperative, especially when considering the consequences in the political realm. The only context in which faith is valid is when it's being used in the context, say, of trust or of expectations. I have faith that the sun will rise tomorrow, or I have faith that my friend will do what is right. Or, when it comes to flying in a jet aircraft, which argument would convince you that it's relatively safe? The one that says that, well, we just believe the plane will fly, so it will. Or the one that says science has repeatedly demonstrated that it is so. I mean, given that choice, I'll put my faith in science, and not in some mystical, undemonstrated beliefs about why aircraft can appear to be made lighter than air. Or I might say that I have faith that the right will ultimately prevail over the left, but I certainly cannot claim any knowledge of that future outcome. I suppose you could say that both optimism and pessimism are expressions of faith. And even as I say this, you know, it's occurring to me that faith, whenever applied outside of religious doctrine, seems to generally be directed towards the future, and that the only distinction between the two contexts of faith is that the mystical version represents a blind acceptance of something in the absence of evidence or proof, while the faith based on reason and experience is really better described as knowledge, quote unquote, except for the fact that future knowledge is a contradiction in terms. Western culture was once in a position to argue that it was partly based on faith in brotherly love and mutual respect, etc., until, ironically, people of faith demonstrated that this is not so. And this is where the correlation between faith and the use of violence is critical to understand. As observed by Ayn Rand, quote, faith and force are corollaries. Every period of history dominated by mysticism was a period of statism, of dictatorship, of tyranny, end quote. But here's a really interesting passage taken from John Galt's speech in the novel Atlas Shrugged, and I quote, "Do not say that you are afraid to trust your mind because you know so little. Are you safer in surrendering to mystics and discarding the little that you do know? Live and act within the limit of your knowledge and keep expanding it to the limit of your life. Redeem your mind from the hawk shops of authority. Accept the fact that you are not omniscient, but playing a zombie will not give you omniscience. That your mind is fallible, but becoming mindless will not make you infallible. That an error made on your own is safer than 10 truths accepted on faith, because the first leaves you the means to correct it, but the second destroys your capacity to distinguish truth from error," end quote. Wow, that speaks directly to our case made in last week's show. You might recall that both the theistic view of Christian Nick Freites and the atheistic view of Ayn Rand essentially arrived at the same conclusion that truth is not subjective, but is objective. Unfortunately, the theists argued their objectivity on the basis of intrinsic faith, while the atheist objectivist explained their conclusion by reason and logic. "The source of objective morality is Christianity," argued Freites, whereas Rand argued that axiomatic concepts are the foundation of objectivity. Well, given their seemingly similar moral values, but completely incompatible means of arriving at those values, the question arose as to whether these two groups on the right can nevertheless be viable political allies in their mutual opposition to all things left. So far, although willing to cooperate, the most resistant to such an alliance have been the religious intrinsicists. And this is why Rand and other objectivists always objected to people defending individual and freedom on the basis of faith, because this would deny freedom a defense on the basis of reason and reality. And accepting a truth based on faith destroys one's capacity to distinguish truth from error. Which brings us to our next chapter on the relationship between faith and the use of force. The term anti-Semitism is exactly the same as the term Islamophobia. Both are anti-concepts calculated to justify the censorship of any criticism against each religion respectively. And when I hear people use these terms as pejoratives, what I'm really hearing is someone saying, okay, we know we're nuts and irrational, but we don't want you to mention it, so shut up or we'll punish you. It's each religion's version of the term conspiracy theory, created by intelligence operatives to prevent criticism of their statements. But if we really want to understand why there has so rarely been peace on earth and goodwill towards men on this earth, perhaps the greatest culprit in this regard is the political ideology of Islam, which masquerades as a religion. And here to explain the real history of Islam is Raymond Ibrahim, as he appeared on the December 14 edition of Trigonometry.
Raymond Ibrahim, welcome to Trigonometry.
Happy to be with you guys.
You are someone who's written a bunch of books, particularly about the Islam and the interaction between Islam and Christianity. The most interesting thing to start with, I think, is to talk about how Islam comes into being. It doesn't exist. Christians and Jews have existed for hundreds of years at this point. Tell us about the start of Islam.
The standard idea, the rise of Islam, of course, is tied up to the person of Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, who's born around 570 AD in the Arabian Peninsula. And by the time he's 40, around 610, he starts having revelations, as he calls it, by the angel Gabriel, who tells them, Iqra is the word we get Quran from, which means recite. And so he supposedly starts reciting what becomes the Quran, the verses. And this goes on year after year for decades, actually. And these are all, so now you have the Quran is supposedly based on that, and you have surahs, which is essentially chapters made of ayahs, which are verses which he supposedly recited because Gabriel told him. And these are supposed to be understood as the words of Allah, the God of Islam. Islamic law has to govern the whole globe. And so if you are a Christian or a Jew, you have to live in tribute, you know, pay tribute, and you're like second class citizen. And if you're not, you do have to convert. If you're a pagan, if you're a Buddhist or a Hindu, theoretically, you're supposed to convert or die. You can't even pay tribute. So I just tell you that to give you the idea. So when they do jihad and they say it means to strive or struggle, that makes it all the much worse, because historically, the only way you're going to spread Islam was through force and violence. Who's going to accept it? But today, of course, you are able to trick people and empower Islam, not through force. So there's all these classifications of different kinds of jihad, which is different forms of struggle. And they actually have, I can give you quickly their names in Arabic, you know, jihad al-lisan, jihad of the tongue, jihad al-qalam, you know, jihad of the pen, jihad al-mal, jihad of the money, wiladat al-jihad, or basically the baby jihad. All of these, in their own way, help empower Islam. So with your mouth, you can engage in propaganda. With your money, you can support disseminating Islam. You can support terrorist groups. And with your womb, women are encouraged to have as many kids as they can, Muslim women, and men also, to impregnate women, including non-Muslim women, with their seed. So you can, you know, inundate the world with Muslims. And these are actually, this isn't me theorizing. This is actually lots and lots of Islamic clerics have, modern day clerics, articulated what I'm telling you right now. So they became, okay, so what is tribalism? The tribalism of Arabia, which also prevailed in most tribal societies, pastoral societies, was basically, what is tribalism? It's me and my kin. You know, that's it. Everyone outside of the tribe is the enemy. That's how tribalism works. It's not that we're not your friends. You are the enemy. You exist for me to kill and plunder and enslave and do whatever with. What Muhammad did is he maintained that paradigm, which was integral to the Arab society that he was born in. But like I said, he rearticulated with these Islamic teachings. So now you still hate people. The Quran commands people, Muslims, to hate not outside tribal people, but anyone who's not a Muslim. And you can see how that's tribalistic, because we are the Ummah, right? The nation, we are the Muslims. Everyone outside of it, we are commanded to hate. And this is in the Quran. This is Quran 64. Where Allah says you have a good example in Abraham or Ibrahim, because this gives you another really good example of what I'm talking about, how Islam appropriates the biblical figures but recasts them in a way that validates itself. When he leaves Abraham in the Bible, there's nothing about hating anyone. In the Quran, all of a sudden, God, Allah tells Muslims, you have a good example in Abraham, because he told his kin, we hate you and enmity will last between us until you believe in Allah alone. And so that became sort of an Islamic, and in the Quran, it also says similar things about how a true Muslim can't, he has to have these feelings and disassociate from his father, his mother, his brother, his wife. I have an Islamic cleric recently who I translated a while back, who literally says, because of this doctrine, you can, as a Muslim, marry a Christian or a Jewish woman, people of the book, because that is permitted in Islam, but you have to hate them and you have to show them you hate them. But you can copulate with them and, you know, but you always have to make sure they know you hate them. Okay, so this is an ironclad teaching. And as you can see how, so this is tribalism, of course, 101, but now it has a theological veneer. And then, so what do you do in tribes? We hate each other. Well, I go and I plunder you, right? So that became jihad. And jihad is warfare on the outsider, who I am already bred to hate. Okay, and so that manifests in jihad. And so and then if you die, right? So you're the warrior, you hate the infidel, you do jihad. But now, if you win, well, you get all these whatever, the booty, you know, animate and inanimate, you can gain. And if you die, you get even more. Now you go straight to heaven, straight to paradise, where it's, again, hedonistic and materialistic. And you get women. And, you know, it's very carnal, the way it's described in the Quran, okay? You know, there's beautiful boys circulating around looking like pearls, and these supernatural women who you will copulate with in perpetuity, who are made specifically for sex, okay? And rivers of wine, etc.
Rivers of wine?
Yeah, yeah. Now you can drink wine once you get to heaven, but not here.
I just wanted to concentrate on the Islamic Golden Age.
What needs to be understood about the Golden Age is this. It didn't happen due to anything to do with Islam, quite the contrary. It happened despite Islam. Keep in mind, when these Arab Muslim conquests happen, most of, so let's say Egypt and Syria, which were highly Christian, let's say in the 8th century, 9th century, 10th century, they're still majority Christian. Mm-hmm. And there's Jews also as well, especially in Alexandria and various cities. And you have a lot of Zoroastrians in Persia. Okay, you have all these different groups who are living underneath now Islamic rule. They're the ones who are doing all the stuff that we call the Golden Age. Okay, it's Christians, it's Jews, and especially it's Persians in the Abbasid era. And it's not because of anything special about Islam. I mean, they are literally not Muslims. Okay, but there was nothing intrinsic to Islam. And once Islam started to harden, all that stuff started dwindling away. The Islamic world, as I was kind of telling you, its entire economy was based on war and plunder and slave and the slave system. Okay, they never produced anything the way Europe eventually went to, especially technologically and militarily. So I think once any Muslim region power is unable to conquer and plunder, it has no economy and it starts falling apart. And this happened before, so the Ottoman Empire still persists. And why does it persist? Because it westernizes. Whereas the rest of the Middle East, you know, Egypt, and which was by then sort of run by the Mamluks, and all these other areas are completely now just spent, you know. There's nothing to plunder. There's no economy. Everything's falling apart. It's very easily taken over. But the Ottomans, they westernize, mm-hmm. which is ironic because the Ottomans were the chief, standard bearers of jihad. They actually took to jihad and articulated it more than the Arabs, their forebears, did. That was their thing, okay? And you know, under Ataturk, they actually got rid of the Arabic script, took the Roman alphabet, dressed in Roman attire, Western attire, shaved the beards, et cetera, et cetera. So everyone became westward looking, including, you know, the Muslims who could, because that was the way to, you know, win. And the Islamic way, now that it became a spent force at this point. And it was kind of an anachronism. It really didn't have much the way it did things was no longer going to work in this new world with Europe the way it was. Here's the difference between Islam historically and Islam today. Mm-hmm. The continuity is that Muslims are creating problems, okay? They did it historically, the violence and the intolerance and the supremacism, okay? And it's happening now in the present. The difference is historically, like I said, it was the jihad of force. right? They had no choice. No one was going to let them in. So Europeans fought tooth and nail, you know, fighting to the death. Now, the problem is, I think you mentioned it earlier, or I don't know if it was you, Francis, but you talked about Muslims, how they're very weak right now. And, you know, they're a weak force. Why are they a problem? And the answer is because the West makes them a problem, or the specific country in the West, let's say the UK, okay? All the problems that the UK is going through, for an example, and not just UK, much of Western Europe, it's all self-made, okay? And you know that because I can look at an Eastern country like Hungary, and it has none of these problems. Is that because Muslims tried to invade Hungary by force, and somehow the Hungarians resurrected John Hunyadi and they beat them back? No, they just said, no immigration. We don't want it. And guess what? No problem. Get your terms right. This is not an invasion. An invasion is when people come by force and they're trying to take it. This is an invitation. Okay. This is an enablement from your leaders. And the heart of the problem today with Europe and Islam, it's really not the Muslims. Muslim's a Muslim. He's going to have the anti-infidel thing going on, the tribalism that I mentioned. Okay. But why are they being brought in with all these massive numbers? Why are the native Brits, let's say, or Europeans in general, being their heritage and their religion and their cultures being suppressed to make room for these people in the name of some sort of amorphous tolerance or, you know, multiculturalism, which is obviously not working? And it's actually, in a way, easily fixed if the actual supposedly elected representatives of these various nations do the will of the people.
Just a guy goes up to somebody in the street, stabs them, no provocation, nothing. What is that designed to achieve? What's the point of that?
That's actually a good question. What they are teaching is in the Quran. So when they, so Quran 9:5, famously, it's known as a sword verse, okay?
So what you're saying is, and correct me if I'm misunderstanding, this is not strategic, this is doctrinal.
Yeah. The bottom line is Islam is what Islam is, okay? And unlike other religions, it's very black and white. You know, the whole concept, the problem with Western people is they project their own religion, kind of, and then they're convinced that, for example, Christianity is, you know, separation of secular and spiritual, you know, Caesar and the coin and whatnot, but that's not Islam. Islam is not us. It's not about the condition of your heart and relationship you have with God. It's actually all about the law. It's legalistic.
Raymond, I'm going to ask a provocative question, but I think it's an important one. Do you think the religion of Islam is compatible with the West?
No, it's not. And if you mean by the West, the sort of secular liberal West, it's certainly not. If the West believes in freedom of religion and gender equality and everything that the West, you know, prizes, well, in Islam, it's not that there's a radical interpretation. Honestly, it's not. Like I told you, that's the observant interpretation. You have to hate the non-Muslim. Is that something that, you know, if you're living in a liberal Western secular society, you really want a group of people who are bound to feel that way towards you? How's that going to work out? Oh, I know how it works out. Just look at the UK, right?
And so I guess the next question is, if it's completely antithetical, is it therefore an existential threat to the West?
Yeah.
You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. To say that Islam is not compatible with the West is a gross understatement. Islam is not compatible with human life, period. It is a death cult, no different than is leftist ideology across the board. Islam, I find it offensive, both literally and morally. I have never, in all my years of talking about this quote-unquote religion, ever heard of a single positive value exclusively associated with Islam. Nothing. If anyone can identify one, please let me know. And if ever there was a living example of how faith and force go hand in hand, Islam is Exhibit A. As we heard, the Islamic world's entire economy is based on war, plunder, and slavery. The point of the violence is doctrinal, the pure politics of plunder. Islam law must govern the whole globe, which is as pure an expression of globalist theocracy as you can find. Islamic culture creates nothing and destroys everything. It is totally parasitic on the cultures around it. Second-class citizens must pay tribute, another euphemism for taxation and theft. How on earth do such inferior-minded people come to see themselves as being first-class? and talk about sexual perversion and hypocrisy. If you die and you win, you can get to paradise and heaven, and it's all hedonistic and materialistic. You get free women, very carnal, the way he says it's described in the Quran. There are supernatural women to copulate with in perpetuity who are made specifically for sex, and you can drink wine and alcohol in heaven. You know, when I hear stuff like this, I find it difficult to conceive of anyone, even one human being, swallowing this BS. Islam is a culture of hate. Its adherents are commanded to hate and regard everyone else outside of their collective tribe as the enemy. No reasons necessary. The concept of consent is utterly lacking in Islamist culture. The treatment and legal status of women is reprehensible and immoral. More so, the treatment and status of children. To me, all of this is just simply unconscionable. Talk about tribalism. And to command that true Muslims must disassociate from their father, their mother, their wife, is beyond being somewhat contradictory to its tribal foundations. It's also evil. And of course, true Muslim cultures must also disassociate from non-Muslim cultures, so much so that the Islamic calendar, which came into being long after the Christian-Roman calendar that was established, does not coincide with it, establishing its own year one on the Islamic calendar in 622 AD on the original calendar. No wonder they object to the word assimilate. Raymond Ibram, while arguing that the continuity of Islam historically and today is that the Muslims are creating problems, nevertheless concluded that Muslims themselves are not the problem, but that the West makes them a problem, not an invasion, but an invitation. And while I understand the logic behind this argument, because it places a necessary responsibility on the politicians of the West for having created the specific problem of violence, rape, theft, and outright intolerance by bringing Islamists into a given nation, I still think that the problem, quote-unquote, is Islam and its adherents themselves. Because even keeping them out of a given country is otherwise an unnecessary waste of time and resources. So when it comes to having peace on earth alongside Islam, well, that requires an act of faith beyond my ability. Now, we're going to go down the ultimate religious rabbit hole. Or maybe on second thought, maybe we might be crawling out of that rabbit hole, especially after hearing the following amazing account of the origin of religious practice itself, right down to the roots of the belief in heaven and hell. Yet another new voice to our show, Marina Karlova, in the following much-edited shorter version of her original November 22 podcast, How Food Poisoning Created Religion.
What of the real foundation of religion and hierarchy wasn't ideas or spirituality, but a lethal grain parasite that caused mass death, collective hallucinations, and synchronized suffering? That our entire system is the result of 10,000-year-old food poisoning event. Yes, this sounds like conspiracy theory territory, but it isn't. It's a very logical, almost mundane explanation, backed by archaeological and biological evidence. So let me walk you through what I think actually happened, because if this pattern holds, we're looking at the biological origin of religion, hierarchy, and power. Here's what we know for certain. Humans started cultivating grain around 10 to 12,000 years ago in river valleys where irrigation was possible. Irrigation-based agriculture required collective coordination. Centralized grain storage was the inevitable organizational form required by irrigation agriculture. But centralized storage created a new problem: mice. The later Egyptian cult of Bastet isn't some random cat worship. It's an expression of how critical rodent control around granaries had become. This creates the conditions for biological catastrophe, which creates the conditions for hierarchical authority. The moment you centralize the food supply, you've created a single point of failure that demands specialist oversight. And that oversight becomes power. But how does this explain religion? ergot was present on wild and cultivated grains in Neolithic settlements, when wild grain storage was distributed across individual households. Ergot poisoning was local, containable, and probably rare. But centralized storage means one contaminated batch mixed into the communal store means everyone eats from the same source. Mice don't just eat grain. They are vectors for ergot spores. You couldn't see the contamination. You couldn't predict it. The only way to know if a batch was safe was to eat it and wait. And ergotism is not subtle. Ergot alkaloids cause vasoconstriction. Blood flow to your extremities shuts down. You feel like you're burning from the inside. Your fingers, your toes, they turn black, gangrenous, and fall off. You're convulsed. You hallucinate fire, demons, torment. Medieval Europeans called it Saint Anthony's fire. This might be where the concept of hell comes from. Not some metaphysical speculation, direct physical experience of communal catastrophe. The fire, the demons, the inescapable suffering. That's the symptom profile of ergot poisoning. And when it hit a centralized granary, it hit everyone simultaneously. Chemically, these compounds sit in the same family as lysergic acid, the precursor of LSD, which is why they don't just hurt. They hijack perception so hard that entire villages can end up sharing the same visions. Think about what this creates psychologically. Your entire community in synchronized agony, watching children burn, experiencing collective hallucinations of demonic torment, seeing bodies mutilate themselves through gangrene. This is visceral, witnessed, shared experience. The community needs someone to check grain before it enters the shared supply. Someone has to eat first. Enter the priest. Initially, this is rational specialization, not parasitism yet. They consume a small portion of new harvests. If they stay clear-headed, the batch is safe for distribution. If they start experiencing visions, seeing gods, monsters, hear voices, that's the signal the grain is contaminated. Small doses of ergot alkaloids don't kill you, they make you hallucinate. The dose makes the poison. A priest eating small test portions from contaminated batches wouldn't die. He'd just have an LSD trip. So the priest tripping becomes the test result. Visions mean reject the batch, clarity means distribute. This practice is documented across cultures. The tithe, the first fruits, the offering to God. We've been taught this was symbolic tribute. It wasn't. It was biological safety protocol. For generations, this works. The priest eats first, either stays lucid or channels divine forces. The community follows his guidance. Everyone survives. It's effective biological screening, but the practice becomes ritual. The next generation doesn't remember this started as a neurological contamination testing. They just know the priest must eat first, must be open to divine communication. The function is forgotten, the form remains. And then someone breaks the rule. They eat without the blessing, and they burn. Not because gods are real, because they ate from a contaminated batch that no one tested. But the community doesn't know about fungal spores or biological mechanisms. They see person violated the ritual, person experienced literal hell. The causal connection is established, incorrectly, but powerfully. The priest's authority is no longer about food safety testing. It's about protection from divine wrath. And that authority is empirically confirmed when a violator suffers and an obedient person survives. Because no one understands the actual mechanism, the religious interpretation becomes the only available explanation. But now consider the power dynamic this creates. Your role isn't ideological authority. It's material survival gatekeeping. You're not asking people to believe in invisible entities. You're providing protection from visible, experienced nightmare. The memory of the fire, not metaphorical future punishment, but immediate witnessed death, sometimes mass death, creates absolute dependency on whoever promises protection. Eat our blessed bread, follow our rules, or burn. Not eventually, not in some afterlife. Burn now, in front of everyone, while your extremities rot off and demons dance in your peripheral vision. You don't believe the priest because he's charismatic. You believe him because last time you didn't follow his rules, your daughter burned alive and you watched her fingers turn black and fall off. Look at what this pattern explains across the archaeological record. Temples functioned as granaries, confirmed, not speculation. Early state structures emerged as temple states, administrative centers built around grain storage and distribution. The earliest writing systems tracked grain inventory. The first bureaucracies managed harvest collection and redistribution. Ancient Sumerian texts have specific terminology for different types of grain fungal contamination. They knew this was system critical. The priest doesn't just perform rituals, he literally eats the first portion of community grain supply. This is documented from Mesopotamia to Egypt to early Chinese dynasties. Hell, as fire and demons, appears in most grain-based civilizations, except those based on rice or corn. Not in hunter-gatherer cosmologies, not in purely pastoral cultures, not in mountain regions that avoided grain cultivation. But wherever centralized grain storage appears, you get burning, torture, demons, punishment for disobedience. And look at the traces of this system in religion. The rituals tell you exactly what the society was terrified of. Bread is the center of every sacred act because the real fight was always over safe grain. The blessing before eating is the literal hope that this bread won't kill your entire family. Later prayers like "Give us this day our daily bread" preserve this ancient anxiety. Although, if you want to be precise, today you probably should address this prayer to the FDA and always check the expiration date. Communion, the priest eating first in front of everyone, is just a safety test fossilized into ceremony. The wine isn't symbolic redemption. Alcohol is a vasodilator. It opens up blood vessels that ergot tries to clamp shut, so drinking wine with risky bread could easily have increased your chances of surviving the meal. That's why it makes perfect sense that it ended up next to the bread. Looks like the Old Testament isn't just a holy book. It's the archived operations manual of the first biosecurity state. Why did religion suddenly have enough power to override rational self-interest? Because the alternative to obedience was watching your community burn. Why did hierarchical religion emerge specifically with grain agriculture? Because centralized storage created the vulnerability that required biological gatekeeping. And 10,000 years later, we're still living inside the structure, long after everyone forgot why it was built.
It really never occurred to me that when I was an altar boy serving Catholic masses, that what I was participating in during the ceremony of communion, with the priest eating first in front of everyone, that it was just a safety test fossilized into ceremony. But you know, it all makes a lot of sense. Now, there was nothing sinister or spectacular about her account of how religion and power arose. As she said, it was rather mundane and logical, and the narrative also illustrates the basic necessity of something akin to government. Necessity is the mother of invention, as we used to say. And in terms of ancient causal connections being lost between the original reasons for a religious practice and the modern-day fossilization of such, just a day or so ago, I heard an account of this same phenomenon existing with respect to modern Islam. Apparently, a woman walking her dog in London, England, was asked by the police to leave her street because nearby Muslims were offended by the dog. Now, why would a dog bother them? Because they believe that dog saliva is considered to be ritually impure. This private belief became a religious one. Doesn't that sound a lot like the safety test fossilized into ceremony? Now, I have to question and challenge the notion of what we've been calling freedom of religion, in the sense that by specifically citing religion as a beneficiary of freedom, we are saying that, in effect, the law will protect your right to think and behave irrationally, to the exclusion of non-religious thinking. Think about it. Religious exemptions were recently an okay reason to avoid having to take a COVID shot, but rational arguments were not. A broad and universal application of freedom of speech along with the right to consent might go a long way to resolving this inequity. But as for religion itself, the generic definition of religion refers to the practice of one's beliefs or convictions. For most people, this means a faith system. But beyond the realm of supernatural faith, there is the pragmatism of human behavior. And I've mentioned this before. For example, people who exercise quote-unquote religiously, or musicians who practice quote-unquote religiously. To do something religiously in this sense implies that you no longer think about it, you just do it. But it doesn't mean that there wasn't initially some rational reason or purpose behind the religious behavior, or that upon discovering that a given religious habit is no longer useful or harmful, that the individual in question would not reconsider it. So, having said my bit about religion, once again, here's wishing all of you a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And here's also wishing that all of you religiously join us each and every week as we continue our journey in the right direction. So until next week, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be
But the big enemy is stupidity, right? I want to share with you the most stupid tweet I ever got, I think. All right. Now, admittedly, when I first got on Twitter, I pushed my agenda a little bit. I was an outspoken atheist, not because I thought I'd change anyone's opinions, but because I thought it was important to tell the other side, you know? That there are still 13 countries where people are put to death just for being an atheist, and there's people bullied, and I just wanted to say, it's fine to be an atheist, it's fine to believe in God, and it's fine not to. That's all I was saying, really. And then I realised I didn't even have to tweet about religion or atheism. I could just tweet a fact, and that annoyed just the right people, right? I tweet things like, happy birthday, Earth, 4.6 billion years old today. And someone would always go, oh, we know what you're f***ing doing, we know what you're doing, right? So, this is a tweet I got from someone after one of those, I assume, right? Best tweet ever, right? Your science, my science, right? Science, by the way, is spelled S-C-I-E-N-T-S. Already good, isn't it? I mean, he's obviously heard the word, he took a guess. Never seen it written down, because it's not in the Bible. So, he's... Your science won't help you. Well, it will. It's helping him beam this little message up to a satellite and down to me. Your science won't help you when Satan is raping your British ass. And he's got a point. Because if I die and I find myself in hell being raped by Satan, science has pretty much let me down.